Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Frankie Goldfarb, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the April 14th, 2024 issue. The first article is the cover story, and it's titled The Trials of Alvin Bragg. The Manhattan DA's case was considered the runt of the Trump indictments, but now he finds himself leading the first prosecution of the former president, and perhaps the only one before the November election. This article is by Kim Barker, Jonah Bromwich, and Michael Rothfield. Reporters vied for seats in the briefing room, some even crouching on the floor. They all knew on this Tuesday in early April 2023 that Alvin L. Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney, was about to announce something monumentous, the first criminal charges against a former American president. Yet, when Bragg walked quietly onto the stage, it took a second or two for the audience to realize he was there. In his dark blue suit and dark-rimmed glasses, he blended into the dark blue curtains behind the lectern. He took out his notes and thanked everyone for coming. He was flanked by poster boards with flowcharts, but that was as far as the showmanship went. The accusations he went on to level against Donald J. Trump were salacious, involving money paid to a porn star just before the 2016 presidential election, so she would remain silent about her claim they had sex a decade before. But Bragg studiously avoided mentioning sex or hush money during the 13-minute event, focusing instead on 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up the payment. Bragg looked frequently at his notes while he spoke, mostly in a monotone. He seemed unprepared or unwilling to answer the most obvious questions. Why he had abandoned a different case about whether Trump had falsified the valuations of properties, or why he thought he could make these new charges stick. Bragg displayed passion only once, in response to a question about why he brought a hush money case after his predecessor and federal prosecutors had not. Quote, "This is the business capital of the world," Bragg said, his voice rising. "We regularly do cases involving false business statements. The bedrock, in fact, the basis for business integrity and a well-functioning business marketplace, is true and accurate record-keeping. That's the charge that's brought here, falsifying New York State business records." End of quote. True and accurate record-keeping, it's hardly the stuff of history books. But a year later, it is this paperwork case, not the three other indictments that have dominated the news involving accusations of trying to overturn a presidential election and mishandling highly classified documents, that will, in the coming days, make history as Trump's first criminal trial, and perhaps the only one before the election in November. Hardly anyone figured that it would play out this way. Bragg himself had said that broader justice may warrant another case going first. Yet with those other cases mired in legal skirmishing and delay, it is Bragg, a Harvard-trained prosecutor who has often appeared to be the most uncomfortable, unmedia-savvy public figure, who will now face off against the reality television star turned Republican former president, master of spin, media-ready insult, and creation of his own narrative. Bragg's legal argument is complicated, but it stems from a simple episode. In the days before the 2016 election, Trump's personal attorney and fixer, Michael D. Cohen, paid $130,000 in hush money to the adult film star Stormy Daniels. Prosecutors argue that Trump, who denies that he had sex with Daniels, then lied on 34 business records, 12 ledger entries, 11 invoices, and 11 checks to disguise his payment of Cohen as legal fees. On its own, falsifying these documents would be misdemeanors, relatively minor crimes. Bragg elevated each of the charges to felonies by arguing that they were committed to hide or further another crime, which, in an unusual move, he did not charge. He said he wasn't required to specify that crime, but added that it might have been a violation of state or federal election law. What may further complicate the case is that it relies heavily on testimony from Cohen, a disbarred lawyer who served prison time after pleading guilty to violating campaign finance laws, evading taxes, making false statements to a bank, and lying to Congress. After the indictment, a chorus of critics, some but not all on the right, questioned the legal reasoning, wisdom, and winnability of the hush money case. Today, many experts believe that Bragg's legal strategy looks considerably stronger, validated by a federal judge who rebuffed Trump's effort to delay or even kill the case by having it moved to federal court, and by the Manhattan judge presiding over the case who in February officially greenlit Bragg's premise by setting a trial date. None of which means the case has ceased to be controversial. The furor lives on, primarily in the political space. Trump and his allies have branded the case a witch hunt, a selective prosecution brought by a Democratic district attorney in the pocket of George Soros, boogeyman of the right. Many Democrats, in turn, worry that Trump's narrative of persecution is only fueling his presidential campaign, especially because this case of sexual peccadillo and faked paperwork might look frivolous next to his three other indictments, which cut closer to his presidency and the foundations of American democracy. Quote, "We're all kind of like, I can't believe Alvin is at the center of this," says Aaron E. Murphy, a New York University law professor who is part of Bragg's close-knit friend group from law school and one of the more than 70 friends, colleagues, legal and political experts interviewed for this article. She said, quote, "He's just so non-political. He's like not a hyper-partisan political person in any way, shape, or form. So there's just this dissidents, end quote. Certainly Bragg, who was 50, has never seemed to concern himself much with appearances. His friends have long joked about his wearing rumpled suits or a Boy Scout outfit on a date. If he could have applied for this job instead of campaigning for it, they say, he would have. That's what he did when he became a federal prosecutor and then a deputy New York Attorney General. Each move a step forward in a life devoted to a careful, verging on nerdy practice of the law. To the commitment to service, a word he has often used, that his parents instilled in him when he was growing up on Stryver's Row in Harlem. Bragg himself has seemed almost sheepish about the Trump case, preferring to talk about tackling wage theft or creating a jail diversion program. Just after he announced the indictment last spring, his office sent out its regular roundup of big cases. It listed the Trump indictment not first, not even second, but third, after the conviction of two killers. The office's 2023 highlights list didn't even mention Trump. Bragg declined to comment for this article, concerned about being accused of unethical behavior before a trial. Yet, if Bragg, the district attorney, had been largely quiet about the former president, a look back through his records show that hasn't always been the case. Bragg, the candidate, in fact, was more than willing to talk up his legal bona fides in the matter of Trump. Bragg may lack the polish and presentation of a politician. His friends may insist he's not a politician, but for all his lawyerly reticence, inside his sometimes ill-fitting suits is a man of unmistakable ambition who has hitched his aspirations to the pursuit of Donald J. Trump. Bragg's emergence as a public critic of Trump came at a time when he was relatively unknown outside New York and Harvard alumni circles. And it came in an unusual venue. A video posted in May 2019 by the progressive news outlet called Now This and hosted by the flamboyantly public Trump hater Robert De Niro. In the video, Bragg and 10 other former federal prosecutors said they believed that Robert S. Mueller III's investigation into the Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election had uncovered more than enough evidence to indict Trump. Quote, "This isn't even a close case," Bragg said. Bragg was on a break from public service, teaching at New York Law School. But he was just weeks from announcing his next move, his candidacy for Manhattan District Attorney in an election still 2 years away. The incumbent district attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., had begun his own investigation of the president and his businesses. And even before Vance announced in March 2021 that he would not seek re-election, the race had become a referendum on who would best take on Trump. In a primary campaign of what would be Trump slayers, Bragg sold himself as the most experienced. He talked about supervising the state investigation into the Trump Foundation as chief deputy attorney general in 2017, a case that led to the charity's closure. He said he knew how to prosecute fraud in the valuation of properties, one strand of Vance's Trump investigation. Referring to Trump's criminal policies, Bragg added, he has embraced white nationalism, misconstrued data, and engaged in cronyism, and the result has been a parade of horribles, Bragg told the Wall Street Journal, and that he certainly had more experience with Trump than most people in the world. Those are quotes. A rival Democrat spokeswoman complained that Bragg attacked Trump, quote, for political advantage every chance he gets. Bragg also used Trump to contrast himself with Vance. The attorney general, he argued, had appeared soft on the rich and powerful, declining to prosecute two of Trump's children several years earlier on accusations that they misled potential buyers in the struggling Trump Soho condo hotel. Vance had also met with one of Trump's lawyers, Mark Kasowitz, and accepted his $32,000 campaign contribution just months after rejecting the Trump Soho case. Vance later returned the money. For Bragg, this was a break with lawyerly protocol. To be talking about a potential case before seeing all the facts, at the risk of appearing biased. Yet in this election cycle, and especially with Trump newly vulnerable after his 2020 loss, holding him to account seemed vital to being elected in Manhattan. Bragg's campaign was hardly all Trump. He also championed the sort of criminal justice reform issues. For example, ending long prison sentences for low-level street crimes that had helped progressive prosecutors sweep into the office nationwide. But he seemed to double down on Trump as the campaign went on, simplifying and exaggerating his record. It is a matter of fact that I have sued Trump over 100 times, Bragg told the New York Times in April 2021, an often repeated claim that would be published everywhere from CNN to the BBC. Quote, I can't change that fact, nor would I. That was important work. End of quote. Asked recently for documentation, a campaign spokesman, Richard Fife, sent links to more than 100 news releases. A review of these and court filings found 30 cases in which the New York Attorney General's office had sued Trump or his federal agencies during Bragg's time there, nearly always alongside other states. The office also joined 12 other ongoing lawsuits against the Trump administration, the analysis found. As a top aide to the attorney general, Bragg could have supervised those cases, but taking personal credit seems a bit of a stretch. The district attorney's office referred questions about the lawsuits to Fife, who said Bragg's comments were not written, but made in conversation. Bragg, in fact, did repeat the statement in a written candidate questionnaire. Quote, I will concede, Fife said, that our use of the word suit isn't as limited as your definition. In heavily Democratic Manhattan, primaries typically function as general elections. On primary day in June 2021, Bragg said on Twitter, quote, As Chief Deputy Attorney General of New York State, I oversaw a staff of 1,200 plus people delivering progressive change. I led the investigation into stop and frisk. I didn't just sue Donald Trump and the Trump Foundation. I won. End of quote. On November 2nd, 2021, the night he trounced his Republican opponent, Bragg moved to the microphone at Harlem Tavern as supporters chanted, "Alvin, Alvin, Alvin." His first public remarks were hardly memorable. Quote, "Somewhere deep down inside, I think I always wanted a bar mitzvah," said Bragg, who had long taught Sunday school at the nearby Abyssinian Baptist Church. Quote, "This is new for me, newly elected. I think I can say that now, right?" he asked the crowd, starting his speech, and then he paused, practically giddy, to interrupt himself. Quote, "Look, this is phenomenal." Bragg's remarks made it clear that he saw his election as Manhattan's first Black district attorney as the natural next chapter in the annals of his life. Walking to the tavern on Frederick Douglass Boulevard, Bragg told his supporters his mind flipped back through a personal journey that began along this stretch of what neighborhood old-timers like himself still called 8th Avenue, being dropped off at grade school by his parents, eventually taking the M10 bus there on his own, facing guns pointed at him by the police, graduating from high school. But that was not all. Bragg had one more memory to share. Quote, "I had my first date with Jamila Pronton Bragg on 139th Street and 8th Avenue," he said. "And I was wearing a Boy Scout uniform because I had just come from leading a troop at Abyssinian Baptist Church. And she still ate with me and she married me." End of quote. Bragg's parents, Alvin Sr. and Sadie, raised him to move seamlessly between worlds. They attended church at Abyssinian, a stronghold of Black social justice activism. But they also enrolled their only child as a kindergartner at the Trinity School, one of the city's most exclusive private academies. Bragg, one of a handful of Black students, became the center of a tight-knit group of Trinity kids, friends who were still in his inner circle. "We always called him the mayor," recalls John Scott, who met Bragg in middle school. "He was like the most gregarious and outgoing and charismatic guy, even back then." In a Trinity yearbook entry, Bragg quoted Aristotle, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the music producer Quincy Jones, and himself. Quote, "You and I are like two stalks of corn in a field of love, waiting for the harvest." It was apparently an inside joke. Asked by a journalist during the campaign if he was nerdy, Bragg said, "I think yes and no. I think nerdiness is a little bit context-based." He paused and then added, "I think in any broad sense, yes." The Reverend Al Sharpton, who supported Bragg's campaign and praised his indictment of Trump, described him this way, quote, "He's not the larger-than-life swagger figure of Harlem. He is the result of what those generations produced, a competent, efficient guy. End of quote. Growing up, Bragg's friends say he didn't make a fuss about the three times he remembered the police pulling guns on him on the Harlem streets. Once, several police cars converged on a taxi carrying Bragg and four black friends. The officers, guns drawn, ordered everyone out. They told them they fit the description of some boys who had just committed a crime nearby, then held them for a few minutes before letting them go, recalls Roald Richards, one of the friends. During the campaign, whenever Bragg brought up his encounter with the police, he would also mention the three times criminals pulled guns on him, or would praise the police for keeping the streets safe. Yet if Bragg swallowed those experiences as a teenager, he also described them as fuel for his ambition. He was elected president of his high school senior class. His yearbook described an imaginary 20-year-old reunion in which Bragg was president of the United States. While he was at college, the Harvard Crimson highlighted his ability as president of the Black Students Association to diffuse tensions between warring student groups. The headline, quote, "The Anointed One." Bragg's role, conciliator. He became such good friends with Republicans that years later, one would actually donate money to his campaign, despite the fact that said Republican, Harry Wilson, would later run for governor of New York. At Harvard Law School, Bragg joined the team that won the prestigious moot court competition. Even that makes his path seem preordained. It was the Archibald Cox team, named for the Watergate prosecutor who investigated President Richard M. Nixon. Bragg started out as a lawyer in private practice, representing, among other clients, Native American tribal members who said they had been abused by the police. But he soon became a prosecutor at the state attorney general's office, explaining later that he felt he could make more of a difference from the inside. After 3 years, he left to become a lawyer at the New York City Council. 3 years after that, he joined the U.S. Attorney General's office in Manhattan. After 4 years there, he returned for a second tour of the Attorney General's office. It became a pattern. Bragg never stayed long enough to build a deep record. He seemed in a rush to get somewhere. But in offices where heads-down self-advancement was the norm, Bragg amassed friends and allies. It's all but impossible to find anyone who worked with him who is a negative thing to say. He walked around, often slightly disheveled, messenger bag dangling and tie askew, smiled big and asked, "How are you?" Several colleagues recall being struck by how deliberately he tested the strengths and weaknesses of evidence. Quote, "In every regard, he was one of the smartest people I've ever met. The meticulous," says, "and meticulous," says Joshua Grattinger, who worked under Bragg in the Attorney General's office. And I say that over and over again, meticulous. but is Bragg prepared to take office in 2022? A conflict was brewing between his careful approach to the law and the promises he made during his political campaign. Within days of becoming district attorney, Bragg announced his top policy priorities. From the recesses of his campaign website, he pulled a criminal justice reform manifesto outlining crimes that would no longer be prosecuted, including marijuana possession, trespassing, and sex work. The Day One memo, as it was called, also signaled that illegal gun possession would not mean jail time unless the gun was used in a violent crime. And timing was less than ideal. During the pandemic, murders and shootings rose, and many New Yorkers seemed to believe that things were spiraling out of control. Happy 2022, criminals, the New York Post blared, referring to Bragg as, in quotes, woke new Manhattan DA, close quote. Bragg's ideas weren't exactly radical, but his execution, announcing them as one of his first acts in the biggest job of his life, without anticipating the backlash, made him look like a rookie, like someone who didn't seem to fully grasp that he would be upsetting some of the very people he needed to do his job. The police commissioner rebuked him. Police unions condemned him. A former U.S. Attorney General who hired Bragg and then campaigned for him, Prett Barbara, was disappointed and frustrated by what he saw as an astonishingly clumsy rollout, according to people familiar with his thinking. Bragg had another hangover from the campaign, and that was the case of Tracy McCarter, a nurse accused of killing her husband. Vance had charged McCarter with second-degree murder in September 2020, even though she claimed self-defense and domestic abuse. Activists on social media had defended her. Bragg weighed in, quote, hashtag stand with Tracy, he tweeted on the day she was charged, using the hashtag pushed by McCarter's backers. Quote, prosecuting a domestic violence survivor who acted in self-defense is unjust, close quote. Now invested with the powers of the district attorney, Bragg had to decide whether he would indeed stand with McCarter. Pressing him to do so was a progressive group called Color of Change, whose political action committee had endorsed him and pledged to spend more than $1 million supporting his campaign. It ultimately spent about $425,000, money that helped Bragg overcome his closest opponent's last moment rush of cash. That financial link would become Republican ammunition, for within days of the Bragg endorsement, Color of Change received a $1 million donation from George Soros, the billionaire patron of liberal causes. After the Trump indictment, the former president and his allies pointed to it as evidence that Bragg was under Soros's control. In November 2022, Bragg went into court himself, unusual for a sitting district attorney, to ask the judge to dismiss the McCarter case. Quote, I understand the gravity of this decision, he said, before lapsing into a jumble of legalese. Several days later, the judge, Diane Kissel, dismissed the case, but complained and corrected Bragg for what she called legal errors and potentially politically motivated decisions. The case, she wrote, quote, has reached the point where the public could perceive this dismissal as bought and paid for with campaign contributions and political capital. But in some ways, Bragg had started to get his footing, delivering on some of his campaign promises to take on the powerful and help the less fortunate. He prosecuted hate crimes against Asian Americans, exonerated a sixth defendant in the 1989 Central Park jogger case, and pursued significantly fewer low-level crimes than Vance had. He charged Stephen K. Bannon, Trump's former political strategist, with money laundering and conspiracy for his role in a charity that skimmed from donations for a border wall, a case that is yet to go to trial. Bragg would also obtain indictments of two men with ties to a fellow Democrat, Mayor Eric Adams. It's a very long article. I'll have to stop reading it right now in order to have time to read another article. The next article is titled, Betting on Trump. Many U.S. business leaders have faith that they would find his second administration as congenial as the first. That may be dangerously misguided. And this article is by Jonathan Mahler. There was anxiety in the thin mountain air when the planet's economic leaders gathered in January at Davos for the 54th meeting of the World Economic Forum. Donald Trump had just trounced Nikki Haley in the Iowa caucuses, all but securing the Republican nomination for president. Haley was reliable, a known quantity. A resurgent Trump, on the other hand, was more worrying. The Davos attendees needed reassurance, and Jamie Dimon, the chairman and chief executive J.P. Morgan Chase, had some to offer. In an interview with CNBC that made headlines around the world, Dimon praised Trump's economic policies as president. And in quotes, be honest, Dimon said, sitting against a backdrop of snow-dusted evergreens, dressed casually in a dark blazer and polo shirt. Quote, he was kind of right about NATO, kind of right on immigration. He grew the economy quite well. Trade, tax reform worked. He was right about some of China. Asked which of the likely presidential candidates would be better for business, he opted not to pick a side. I will be prepared for both, he said. We will deal with both. Dimon presides over the largest and most profitable bank in the United States and has done so for nearly 20 years. Maybe more than any single individual, he stands in for the Wall Street establishment and, by extension, corporate America. With his comments at Davos, he seemed to be sending a message of goodwill to Trump on their behalf. But he also appeared to be trying to put his fellow globalists at ease, reassuring them that America, long a haven for investors fleeing risk in less stable democracies, would remain a safe destination for their money in a second Trump administration. But would it? As Diamond noted, for all Trump's extreme rhetoric in the 2016 campaign, his threats to rip up America's international trade agreements and his attacks on globalization and the financial elite, his presidency, like most presidencies, proved to be business friendly. Corporate America wound up with plenty of allies in the administration, from Secretary of the Treasury Steve Mnuchin, a former Goldman Sachs executive, to Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, a Harvard Business School educated bankruptcy guru, to Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, an aspiring Wall Street player. And the Trump administration's economic agenda of reduced taxes and deregulation largely suited corporate America's interests. J.P. Morgan saved billions of dollars a year thanks to Trump's corporate tax cuts. But Trump and those around him are signaling that a second Trump administration would be very different. They promise a more populist economic agenda and a more populist governing style to match, with steep tariffs on imported goods and punitive measures against companies that do business with China. And his team has been clear about the fact that Trump is ready to move ahead without the blessings of the business community. Quote, "You'll see loyalists," said Brian Ballard, a fundraiser and former lobbyist for Trump. "Wall Street supermen who thought they were the smartest guys in the room? That sort of stuff he won't tolerate," close quote. Scholars who have spent their careers studying populist movements are not confused about what to expect. They have seen this sequence of events play out before to disastrous effect, not just on democracies, but on businesses and business leaders. If history offers any guide, they say, it's that the Davos crowd should be more concerned, a lot more concerned, about a second Trump term. For all the free-floating anxiety at Davos, America's executive class seems to be maintaining a baseline faith that its interests aren't really on the ballot in November, that no matter who occupies the White House, the conditions that have kept it at the center of the global economy for a century aren't in any real danger, but those conditions could easily change, and significantly. There may be nothing executives can say or do that would make a difference at this point, but they might want to start considering the options. Quote, "There has been this sense amongst business leaders that we can work with these people, even if they sound kind of revolutionary, because they will give us some things that are useful," says Rory Abdelal, a political economist and professor at Harvard Business School. Quote, "They are missing that this is a moment of systemic danger for capitalist systems as we know them and globalization as we know it." For decades, Americans' business leaders got more or less what they wanted from the White House, regardless of who occupied it. Communism had fallen, the Cold War had ended, and nations around the world were opening up and integrating. The battle of ideas was over, presumably forever. Capitalism had won. At the end of history, there are no serious ideological competitors left to liberal democracy. That's a quote from the American political scientist Francis Fukuyama, and he wrote it in his 1992 book called The End of History and the Last Man. History had ended before. The Gilded Age of the late 19th century marked the last climactic chapter of decades of largely unconstrained corporate growth and ostentatious displays of private wealth. Then, as now, populace protested. Depression and war came next, accompanied by a new regulatory regime, the New Deal. Years of rapid growth and reduced income inequality followed, and they came to an abrupt halt with the oil crisis and recession of the mid-1970s. Free market orthodoxy, now in the name of neoliberalism, began another ascent under the democratic regime of Jimmy Carter and reached its full power under Ronald Reagan's presidency in the 1980s. The Democrats who followed Reagan largely hewed to the same pro-business handbook, limiting government interference in the economy. Corporate America, and Wall Street in particular, rarely shy in their efforts to capture the government and deploy regulatory powers to their own ends. They found an increasingly warm welcome in Washington. They sent a steady stream of people into positions of power in each successive administration, while at the same time hiring armies of lobbyists and donated generously to political campaigns and political action committees to preserve the status quo. After Brexit, the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the European Union in 2016, there could be no doubt that history had started again. A new populist wave had already begun, swelling for years, but the world's business leaders were nevertheless blinded by the referendum's passage, having vastly underestimated the growing backlash against globalization. Stock markets around the world tanked as investors worried about what this new wave of nationalism might mean for Europe and the broader economy. For many British businesses, the effects of Brexit have been devastating, reducing investments, increasing costs, and creating both labor and supply shortages. Populism has continued its march over time, with citizens around the world seemingly eager to burn down the neoliberal global economic order. Trump's rise seemed to mark the arrival of this wave on America's shores, but his anti-globalist rhetoric on the stump didn't amount to much once he was in office. The business community got the tax cuts and deregulation that it wanted, even if Trump's public image created problems for executives who had to answer to shareholders or employees. After Trump's comments defending white supremacists at the protests in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, a number of prominent executives resigned from two presidential business advisory councils, forcing him to disband its groups. Then, when Trump refused to accept the results of the 2020 election, and again in the aftermath of the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, nearly 50 chief executives, including the heads of Johnson & Johnson and Walmart, came together to rally behind America's democratic institution. Still, when all was said and done, the Trump presidency was good for business leaders, driving up stock prices and spurring an increase in mergers and acquisitions and initial public offerings. Their memories of that era have surely been made rosier by their frustrations with President Biden, who has been a much more proactive regulatory man. His Securities and Exchange Commission has issued a raft of rules constraining the conduct of financial institutions. His Federal Trade Commission and Justice Department have begun an aggressive antitrust crusade, and his National Labor Relations Board has pursued an unambiguous pro-union agenda. The Biden administration is also notably light on former corporate executives. Quote, "Nobody there is wired into the business world, even in seats where you would normally find them, like Treasury or Commerce," says Lloyd Blankfein, the former chairman and chief executive of Goldman Sachs. Quote, "They don't seem to want any." But scholars of populism warn that a second Trump administration could be far more destabilizing to America's business leaders and to the larger global economic order. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, detailed many potential dangers ahead in a report last year. Quote, "How does business fare under populism? Examining the recent economic histories of Hungary, Brazil, and India, she found that populist governments significantly increase volubility and risk by using their regulatory power to tilt markets or outright take control of businesses. The report makes for ominous reading for those accustomed to the comfort and stability of the neoliberal orthodoxy. The business community here doesn't understand what it is about ready to hit them," Kleinfeld told me. Trump has made no secret his intentions. Over the course of his campaign, he has outlined a radical program of protectionism, calling for a phase-out of all essential goods from China, as well as a ban on investments in China and on federal contracts for any company that outsources labor to China. All of this would be concerning enough for American business, but Trump has also proposed a 10% tariff on all imported goods, which would amount to a declaration of global trade war, with other countries almost certainly retaliating with their own tariffs. Together, these protectionist policies would drive up the cost of goods, create sweeping supply chain issues, and quite possibly cause hyperinflation. "We're talking about massive economic shockwaves," says Lisa Graves, executive director of True North Research, a national watchdog group that studies government oversight of business. "The tariffs are just the beginning. Trump's promise to initiate what he calls the largest deportation operation in American history could be catastrophic for employers already facing a tight labor market. Trump's evolving policy views are in step with the broader populist migration of the conservative movement. Last year, Project 225, excuse me, 2025, an effort of more than 100 conservative organizations led by the Heritage Foundation published a 900-page report called Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise, which is essentially a blueprint for a second Trump administration. In addition to embracing radical protectionism, it calls for the next president to reduce the power of the Federal Reserve, limiting the ability to serve as a so-called lender of last resort for banks and other financial institutions facing cash crunches. This would increase the risk of financial crisis, undermining confidence in the U.S. banking system and its financial markets. The power of the Federal Reserve to step in and provide economic relief to stop the spread of economic chaos is what saved us in 2009, Graves says. To limit any internal opposition to his agenda, the report also calls for Trump to reimpose an executive order that Biden revoked, enabling him to fire thousands of civil servants across his administration and replace them with political appointees. There are other, more existential reasons for concern, too. A hallmark of populist leaders is to tighten the state's grip on the business sector, a phenomenon that Ian Bassin, a lawyer and pro-democracy activist, called autocratic capture. To get a sense of how this works, consider Hungary under Prime Minister Viktor Orban, a close Trump ally. Like Trump, Orban governed as a traditional pro-business conservative during his first term as prime minister between 1998 and 2002, cutting taxes and lowering government spending, in part to prepare Hungary to join the European Union. But he was very different as a leader, returning since in 2010. In order to consolidate and maintain his power, he has nationalized parts of the private sector, forced banks to reissue mortgages at more favorable rates, ordered utilities to lower prices, levied crisis taxes on various industries, and imposed price caps on foreign-owned supermarkets. Well, that's it for this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I've been reading from the April 14th, 2024 issue. I'm Frankie Goldfarb. Have a great day, and thanks for listening to Chris.